Thank you so much for having me, Rabbi Kelman. And this is really amazing to see so many people here. And what a beautiful, I didn't hear the whole shiur, but what a beautiful and appropriate talk about Rachel Imenu. And I guess we're going from Rachel Imenu to Sarah Imenu, so both backwards and forwards. I just want to, I'll share my screen in a minute and talk about Sarah Schneer and what she has to say about the month of Av, or I guess starting in Tammuz, and who she was and why it's appropriate to think about her. But I just thought I would start with some very general thoughts on the question of religious time, which I think are so obvious we fail to see them. And I'll try to keep an eye on the chat, but if I miss a question that you have, just feel free to unmute and make your question known to me through the old-fashioned way of saying it, in case I don't see your hand. So, what do I mean by religious time? This is a kind of idea I got from the philosopher Walter Benjamin, who talks about secular historical time as being empty and homogeneous and moving in a single direction. So the, temple gets destroyed in the year 70, I mean, the second temple, and that's 2,000 years ago. That's empty, homogeneous historical time. What religious time grants us. I mean, not only religious time, right? We all have birthdays, which means somehow we go back to the day we were born, is a chance to revisit the past and to live within a more cyclical, circular time, in which time just doesn't move in one direction, but returns and accrues meaning. And if, the circle of Yizkor and revisiting the dead, that seems like a gift that religion gives us, that if you live a purely secular life, you don't have that chance to return to the people who have died once a year, or first 30 days, and then once a year. So this is what I mean by religious time, the sense that the time that we're in is a return to some past, in which terrible tragedies, terrible historical tragedies occurred in the past tense, and yet in which they recur in the present tense for us. And the possibility of recurrence is in some ways a horror, right? We return to the, rabbinic thought believes that the temple was destroyed on the same day twice. We're returning to, I think, hanging over our heads is this return of a kind of type of violence that we thought was behind us with October 7th. And even calling it October 7th means we will return to it, right? B'shavu banim l'gvulam is a temporal as well as geographical phenomenon. And I'll point out that what comes together in these moments of memory are often taken from very different periods. So the arc that I'm talking about today, which is the arc of Av, as understood through Sarah Schneer's thought, and I'll talk about who she was in a minute. She talks about the 3 weeks, the 9 days, Tisha B'Av. That's an arc that goes back to the destruction of the first and the second temple. And then there's Tuba'av, which takes us to a different kind of time. It's a time that is a kind of mythical, legendary memory of different moments of Jewish history, right? There's the wilderness, there's Beitar, which is, the revolution against the rebellion against the Romans, the failed rebellion of 130. So it's a little bit after the destruction of the temple. And also this kind of strange natural moment when the women of Jerusalem, as it says, in the Mishnah, went out to the vineyards and danced at midsummer. So we're also talking about a season. And one of the things that religious time borrows from, along with historical memory, is the recurrence of the seasons, right? So historical time might only move in one direction, but seasons come and go and return. And one of the things that's going to be very important in my talk is that it is very relevant that Tisha B'Av happens in the summer. So the summer is a recurring season that is borrowed from, and I'm sorry, my alarm clock is going off for some reason. Okay, it'll stop in a minute. It's probably on some recurring, talking about clock. So what does it mean? So basically, religious time borrows from and is closely associated with natural time, which also has a cyclical structure. And the Jewish calendar is complicated because it needs to retain this close relationship to natural time. The Islamic calendar, I don't know if some of you know that Islam also has a lunar calendar, but it's a lunar calendar that doesn't have this weird leap month structure, so that Ramadan can happen at any time of the year. And if it happens in the summer, you're out of luck because it means you're fasting for much longer. But as Jews, we know that Tisha B'Av is always, you know, the breaking the fast comes late in the day. So this is built into the structure of Tisha B'Av, is also a natural cycle. And let me just take a slight detour and talk about how this plays itself out phenomenologically, by which I mean how this plays out and how you feel about the Jewish holidays, because the Jewish holidays are not just memories, they're also structures of feeling. So my wonderful friend, Dina Aronoff, who is a professor here in Berkeley, she talks about the times and places when the seams of the calendar show. And what she means by that is that Jewish holidays are taken from different cultural contexts, arose in different periods of Jewish history, and sometimes they come at very close, two different kinds of holidays are actually strangely close to each other. The example she gives is Elul. Elul is a kind of strange temporal, you feel it to be strange. So for instance, Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is actually a beautiful 10-day cycle, which reproduces in 10 days the entire life cycle of the human being, right? So Rosh Hashanah is all about birth, Hayom Harat Olam, to use my, today is the birthday of the world, whatever that means. It's a moment of birth and rebirth. And then Yom Kippur is dedicated to death, right? We wear our shrouds, as it were. We face death. And people say life is too short, but the truth is it's so long that you forget to remember birth and you forget to remember death. And Yom Kippur every year puts birth and death in such close proximity that we feel it during the 10 days, right? The 10 holy days. But the scene that Dina points out is that you get this amazing punchline, let's call it climactic moment, which is Ne'ila. And then, you know, you break the fast. And then 5 days later, like half the time that you had between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, you're building a sukkah and you're in an entirely different mood. And the reason for this crazy seam, if you want to call it that, this kind of jolt, is that Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur is one kind of holiday cycle that happens to coincide with the pilgrimage festivals, which are linked to not to life and death, but to the seasons and agricultural, the full moon, for instance, right? So Rosh Hashanah, the pilgrimage festival. So these are places. Dina says those 5 days, my friend Dina always says, those 5 days between Rosh Hashanah, between Yom Kippur and Sukkot, when you're running around finding schach, You feel the kind of strangeness of the Jewish calendar, the same show, the patchwork quality of it, the fact that it refers to different moments of time, different cultural contexts, different structures of religious thought. And yet we do it. We move from one to the other, from a festival of life and death, which is really about the individual, to an agricultural festival, to one that's associated with the wilderness, that's associated with the full moon, the nature. So this is an example of the same showing. And I'll point out that we're in the kind of same showing we will be starting tonight. We'll be in a kind of same showing moment, which is the moment between this 3 week festival, observance of tragedy, of memory, to rather rapidly in 6 days, this other observance, which is Tu B'Av. It's funny how close they are when you look at the Hebrew date, right? Tet B'Av and Tu B'Av. You just add the Vav. And there we are in a totally different structure of feeling, a totally different environment. And this kind of seam showing Jewish calendar is one that I think calls out for a certain kind of cultural creativity. So one of the examples of cultural creativity is how do you get the punchline of Ne'ilah to fit with suddenly we're running around building a sukkah? Is this idea that this folk idea that, yeah, Ne'ilah is the closing of the gate, but really you have until the end of Shemini Atzeres. Is it Shemini Atzeres, I think? As a kind of extended due date. I'm an academic, so I know all about extensions and due dates and all that. I live with those. Really, you can get in a guten Viertel, you say. You can get it in. And so what you've done is you've created a meaningful arc around two different Hoshana Rabbah, maybe. Oh, Chaya. Hi, Chaya. Talk about due dates. My Toronto student. Maybe it's Hoshana Rabbah. Of course, we should know when the due date, when the absolute due date really is. But these are ways that, let's call it the lived experience of the patchwork quilt, the complicated patchwork quilt of the Jewish calendar. Oh, Hanukkah. No, Hanukkah's too late. So, I want to talk about how this worked. In the interwar period in the Orthodox girls' school system called Beis Yaakov, and that will bring me to the question of the summer. This is when not only do we tie these holidays together in creative ways and figure out what the mood is and make the mood work for us, through the gift of religious time, through the gift of cyclicality, through the gift of pinning our history to the seasons. But they also reflect our present circumstances, right? So we all are feeling that this Tisha B'Av is different from last Tisha B'Av, right? So this one tells a different story about who we are, right? As Rabbi Pearl so beautifully taught us in the last chair. So this is what I want to look at. What was this season in the interwar period? I'm going to share my screen and I'll talk about, so I hope everybody knows. I'll just say Sarah Schneer is the sort of legendary founding figure of this girls' school system, which still exists. I know we have Beis Yaakov girls in the crowd because I just saw one in the chat. And there's probably more because so many of us had this experience. And Sarah Schneer, I'll just say that in 1933, a book was published called Gesammelte Schriften, which I translated in my book, The Collected Writings of Sarah Schneer. And this book was described as the first sefer. So not a book, but a sefer. I hope everyone understands the difference between a book and a sefer. A sefer is a holy book that you study. You don't just read on your couch. You sit and learn. This is the first sefer ever written by a Jewish woman. And this is how it was pitched. And part of the Sefer is called The Jewish Year. And Sarashnira goes through the Jewish year and talks about what the Jewish year is, and links it to her own experience, links it to Beis Yaakov, links it to, in the same way that we're linking Tisha B'Av now to October 7th, links it to what was current and pressing in her own period. Let me see if I could advance my screen. Oops. Ah, here we go. So this is, so one of the things that you have to know, this is a Sarah Schneer's ID card, the only photo we have of her. And on the left, we have an image from, this is kind of the banner image of my website. If you want to know more about Beis Yaakov, the Beis Yaakov project, this is from one of the summer programs, of Beis Yaakov. So Beis Yaakov, let's say, was and is not just a, you know, school system, but was also very active during the summer. And one of the things that happened in the summer, I'll talk about some of the other things that happened in the summer, is that the Beis Yaakov teachers came together for professionalization, under the, in the beautiful mountains, south of Krakow, which is where their seminary was. And they were in, various towns in the mountains for 3 months at a time. And 3 months that were, three summer months in which the observance of Tisha B'Av was, of course, central. Tisha B'Av happens, obviously, during the summer, in August generally. And Sarah Schneerer begins her discussion of the month of Tammuz of what does it mean that we're observing this fast day, this day, these 3 weeks of gradually increasing mourning rituals in this beautiful season in which, you know, the birds are singing. It seemed to her to be in some ways a kind of disconnect between what they were experiencing. I feel it a little bit more in the drought-ridden California. But, you know, these beautiful green mountains that Sarah Schneerer loved so much and the season in which these mourning rituals were taking place. And let me just say a few words of, you know, what the summer was. The image that we just saw is part of a much larger phenomenon, which is the spending the summer. I mean, it's also the way I grew up. You know, you go to a bungalow colony, you go to the Catskills in the, I think in Toronto, you go to the cottages, you go to camp. This all is a kind of 20th century phenomenon, and it became huge in the interwar period, both for boys and for girls, for secular Jews and for religious Jews. And Sarah Schneerer helped develop ways for Orthodox girls to spend time in the mountains in ways that reinforced rather than loosened their religious observance. Because for many people, the summer season, Sarah Schneerer writes in her diary, I have all these religious friends and they go to the spas or they go to the mountains and they go hiking. And suddenly all these religious stringencies go out the window, or not even religious stringencies, things like kosher. Suddenly they get much looser in their religious observance. So not only is there a strange disconnect between the beauty of the season and the injunction to be mournful, the joy of the season and the injunction to be mournful, there's also a kind of cultural dissonance between the piling on of religious stringencies around questions of mourning in the season and the typical loosening of social structures that keep people religious in the city where you're living in Orthodox enclaves or your parents are watching you. So we have the YIVO autobiographies where people write about what it meant to be a teenager in interwar Poland. You have, yeah, I went to camp, I took my tefillin with me, but, you know, I stopped putting it on during the summer. And Sarah Schneerer herself records such kind of looseness. And I'll just say for her, the what was very important Sorry, this is, I have this slightly out of order. So let me just say that in 1915, Sarah Schneer talked, gave her first public lecture to a group of teenage girls, and she spoke about what, the question of why we read Pirkei Avos, the Ethics of the Fathers, specifically during the summer Sabbaths. And she expounded, here you have her saying, she, this is from her memoir, expounded on the saying of the first verse of Avot 1:1 is make a fence around the Torah. The Torah is compared to a beautiful garden in which the most gorgeous flowers, the most delicious fruit grow. If there's no fence around the garden, evil people and wild beasts could destroy everything within it. So too did our holy sages make a fence around the Torah. So it seems to me that what Sarah Schneer is doing is connecting the summer Sabbaths with, first of all, with the beauty of nature, which was very important for how the Sabbaths were observed in this period, in the beautiful parts of Poland, but not with the beauty of nature as a way to become looser in your religious observance, but as a way to put a fence around this beauty. So she doesn't make this entirely explicit, but I think that's the logic of what it mean, you know, of what she's doing is to provide new ways of thinking about the summer as times of both natural beauty and the intensification of religious feeling. And another way that she did this is by creating, by first of all, by feeling herself. So this is from her diary from 1912, before Bais Yaakov, when she was just getting out of an unhappy marriage and went for a very long hike in the Tatra Mountains. And this is a photo taken in 1934, much later, of girls on a very similar hike to the same place in the Tatra Mountains, where the highest mountain in Poland, it is right next to the deepest lake in Poland. And this is a picture of Bais Yaakov girls on this hike. But Sarah Schneer began as a as an avid hiker, hiking on her own. And she describes her marriage dissolving and taking a therapeutic hike. And the view of the Tatra Mountains was made an enormous impression on her. Once again, I've begun to admire the might of God. What am I compared with these mighty mountains that the eternal should so constantly remember me? This is what she wrote in her diary in the summer of 1912. Coming out of a marriage and having a religious experience in nature. So let me talk a little bit more about how this worked. So what were these places and spaces in which the Bais Yaakov girls spent their summer? This is just talking about, there were camps for young Bais Yaakov girls. There were summer excursions for the teenagers. Who weren't teachers, who worked in factories and places like that, the Benos students. That's, I think, the image I have here on the right. These are girls who belong to the youth movement of Bais Yaakov. They spend 2 weeks together. They're from Kamensk, but this is not in the city of Kamensk. This is in the woods somewhere. And this is the Bais Yaakov teachers coming for professionalization under the beautiful skies of Rabka. By the way, this building is still standing, and the owner of it, who's the grandson of the owner of it in the 1920s and 30s, gave my friend and I a tour, my friend and me a tour of this building. And these are the girls outside the building in 1928, I believe, which is a town. And just to give you an image of this town, this is a town with a significant Jewish population of, you know, innkeepers. It had a mikveh, it had a shul. It was one of the most popular Jewish resort towns. It had mineral springs, hiking trails, promenades, carriage rides. There were free concerts in the park twice a day. So even though what you see is the country, this is a very Jewish town, let's call it. And Beis Yaakov took two buildings on just outside the town every summer, and the girls were experiencing this aspect of the Jewish year in this, these are 16, 17, 18-year-old girls, and Sarah Schneer is teaching them what it means to connect to the destruction of the temple through in within this context. Okay, this is Sarah Schneer's writings from her sefer about the destruction of the temple. Jay, you'll tell me if there's like a pre should I look at, take a minute and look at the chat and see what questions we have?
No, we're fine. You can do that right at the end.
Okay, so the destruction of the temple. Jerusalem has fallen. Twice it has fallen. This is the darkest, most horrifying moment of our history. For 3 weeks now, since the 17th of Tammuz, the day that the walls of Jerusalem were first breached, we have already begun to mourn and lament the destruction of the Holy Temple. This liminal time is the dusk, the very border between sadness and hope. We do not yet know what the future will bring. It is true that the enemy is at the gates, but we still live with the faintest hope. Perhaps a miracle will occur. And finally, the destruction commences. The decree has been signed, our fate sealed. Nothing can help us now. Everything is burning. All is destroyed. Countless Jews are slaughtered, and the rest must take up their walking staffs and set out into the darkness of exile. On the one hand, this is a transparent, simple, I mean, one of the things Sarah Schneer is often described as is a simple thinker, right? This isn't sophisticated theology. But what I want to point to is I think she was a religious genius, as somebody who's like devoted many years of my life to thinking about her. And one of the things that's so brilliant about her, despite the simplicity of this historical thought, I think is the use of grammar and language to really bring us into the moment. So what I'll point out is the use of the present tense, and the use of the present tense in a way that in other words, most of us, when we start the 3 weeks, we know what's coming. I mean, no one doesn't know what's coming. You know it's going to be 3 weeks. It's called the 3 weeks. You know it's soon going to be the 9 days. You know, you prepare, you know, I mean, there isn't any question that the temple is destroyed. This idea that she brings us to a moment before we know what will unfold, I think is one aspect of her genius. I mean, not I feel a little awkward quoting the philosopher Heidegger, who's a member of the Nazi party, but you know, I have to say, Davar b'shem Amro, what Heidegger said, what Benjamin picked up on, is that at any moment we have multiple futures. And this is an aspect of being a human being. The future is unknown. We don't know what next October 7th will look like. We don't know. What Heidegger said, what Benjamin picked up on, is that the past also had multiple futures. The future that got taken, the one that came to pass is not the only one that exists. That if you go back to the past, you will feel other futures. You will feel other possibilities. And some of these possibilities are possibilities of redemption. That's not Heidegger, that's me.
Dr. Simon, could I ask a question?
Absolutely,
When
Shelley.
did she write this? Because she lives in such tumultuous times between World War I and then what's going on. I mean, the Nazis are already 1928. They're already, quite prominent in Germany. So is she talking, is she referencing what's going on in her time when she wrote this?
So she is referencing what, she, and I'll talk when I move to the next slide, I'll talk a little bit about what she's referencing. But here, let's just say that Sarah Schneer, basically dates the beginning of Beis Yaakov to a sermon she heard as a displaced person, a refugee in a synagogue in Vienna when she was there, running away from the front in Galicia during the First World War. So certainly the First World War, and Beis Yaakov was founded in 1917 while the war still raged. So the war and displacement and refugees, those are very much alive. But the main phenomenon that she's dealing with all the time is secularization. So the crisis that Sarah Schneer, and which was not only an issue during the summer when people got lax in their religious observance, and that's still a phenomenon, it was also during the war. It was harder to find kosher food. Sarah Schneer talks about how many families became laxer in their kosher observance. For her, it's attempting to create a meaningful religious structure that will deal not only with the recurring catastrophes of the destruction of the temple and the First World War. Am I remembering right that the First World War was said to have broken out also on Tisha B'Av, or is that only the Second World War? I'm sure someone here knows. All these things that happen around these catastrophes, these major historical catastrophes. But for her, the most pressing thing was the phenomenon of the abandonment of tradition by young people in interwar Poland. And she manages to bring that into the discussion when she talks about the strangeness, right? I talked about the seam showing, the strangeness of you have 3 weeks of lament and mourning, and then you have Shabbos Nachamu, right? She talks about Shabbos Nachamu, the Shabbos after Tisha B'Av, whatever it is this year, 4 days later, suddenly we're okay again. Nachamu, Nachamu, Esami, comfort, comfort you. Says, how does that happen? How can sad feelings disappear so quickly? And here she doesn't connect it to the historical war, but strangely, she tries to connect it to the issue, one that's very close to my own heart and mind and experience, which is why I didn't know what to think about this when I translated it. She compares this to the issue of losing a child. How can sad feelings disappear so quickly? And to me, this not only do we have a very rapid move from lamentation to joy, we also have a slightly incoherent meditation on this. So the seams of tradition and the incoherence of the moment in which she's living, I think, are very close to the surface here. So maybe you'll have, I've thought about this a lot and I haven't come up with any brilliant idea of how it makes sense. But what Sarah Schneer does is she compares this too quick movement of from sadness to joy to losing a child, and losing a child in two ways. So she says you lose a child in two ways. Maybe it does make sense. Now suddenly it's making sense to you. Your pain is enormous. You sit Shiva. Nothing can quell your grief. But after that, you stand up, you grow, you, the child that's lost will never return. But time is simply stronger. You get over it. Things are better. Even the Talmud, which is so emerges from the catastrophe of the destruction of the temple, talks about how things get better eventually. You know, people are walking and things get better. The greatest joy gives way with time and things get better. This is how emotions operate, even when a child is lost. And then she throws in this other thing, which is that they don't get better when the child dies a spiritual death to them. In other words, in her period, when the Hasidic family loses a child because the child, as happens so often in the interwar period, becomes a socialist or a secular Zionist or a communist or intermarries or becomes a Christian. Those were less common in the interwar period than just becoming a secular leftist. And then she writes, as long as that child is still alive, the pain he's causing cannot cease. And the pain is great, But the reason why it's so great is because it's combined with hope. Who is it that said it's not the despair I mind, it's the hope. In some ways, it's the hostages that are still alive. Who knows who's alive? But that is the most painful thing. She writes, Jerusalem is destroyed, but that which still lives and exists, and this is where the slight incoherence is. Because here what lives is the people who keep the religion, right? The people who have not been spiritually lost to the Jewish people. Jerusalem lives and will live. The comfort that washes over us on the Sabbath of consolation is the clearest sign that our mother Zion will finally take us back again onto her lap. Sarah Schneer herself was known as the mother of Beis Yaakov. So she's bringing the language of motherhood. And we just heard about, our mother Rachel, right? Our mother Rachel Imenu. And here she brings us to the comfort and we arise, we wipe off the ash from our foreheads, we shed our mourning clothes. And then we get to Sarah Schneer's greatest invention. And this is the invention of, I just have this urge to stop the share for a minute so I could see people's faces. And my contention is, this is my contention that Sarah Schneer is among her, I said that Sarah Schneer was a religious genius, despite what could be called her religious simplicity. And sometimes simplicity and genius go together. My main proof text for this is that Sarah Schneer seems to have revived the observance of Tu B'Av for modern times. Now, Tu B'Av was revived, according to historians, in 1925 by Zionists in the kibbutzim of the Galilee as a kind of festival of love for secular Zionist youth. What we do know, whether Sarah Schneer knew this or not, I don't know, but in 1926, suddenly the pages of the Beis Yaakov Journal, the newspaper of the movement, are full of calls to revive the festival of Tu B'Av from Sarah Schneer herself. So Sarah Schneer took this festival, and I'll just point out that in its late Second Temple observance, whether this was ever actually observed, we don't have many testimonies to it. There's only one testimony in the Mishnah that talks about the women of Jerusalem going out in borrowed clothing. In that observance, it's a kind of Midsummer's Night romantic find a mate, outdoor, love fest. I don't know what to call it. And in the Orthodox world today, it's sometimes the festival of shidduchim, right? So the rabbis will pray for you to find a shidduch, and, it's devoted again to heterosexual romance and marriage. Sarah Schneer revived Tu B'Av. Right. Exactly. It's the Jewish Valentine's Day. Sarah Schneer revived it not within the context of getting her girls married off. In Beis Yaakov, Beis Yaakov was actually, because of labor shortages within the movement, girls were encouraged to postpone getting involved with Shidduchim. She revived it as a girls-only summertime nature festival. And this was observed. And what I want to show you in the minutes that remain to me is a little bit of how she described this festival, its importance for the, absolutely, married couples too, what it meant for her in her description of the Jewish year, and then how it was that we're very fortunate to possess a first person account of how it was actually observed in the summer of 1932, I believe it was, or maybe 33, in a small town in Poland with a group of the Siakow teachers. So that's just to introduce the rest of my my talk here, and I'll try to race through it so we'll have time for questions. And let's see, here's my from current slide. Oh, here we go. So the 15th of Av, suddenly we have, after Tisha B'Av, a festival of absolute joy. And, oh my God, do I have the, So I, you know what, I don't, I somehow lost part of it. What she says is that, isn't this beautiful? We have here a festival in which, girls wear borrowed dresses. This is one way that Besyakov actually functioned. Besyakov, had certain kind of, let's call them socialist tendencies. I'll remind people that there was an Orthodox socialist party in the interwar period called Poalei Agudas Yisrael. And the leaders of Poalei Agudas Yisrael were also very involved in Besyakov. So Besyakov had a clothing closet where if you had a simcha to go to and you didn't have a nice enough dress, you could sit, you could borrow someone else's dresses. So she brought together the concept of wearing borrowed dresses, which were supposed to keep the boys from choosing girls who came from rich families. So you couldn't tell by looking at what someone's dress was, whether they were rich or not, so that you, you chose your mate only from the purest motives. The purest motives here being erotic attraction. I guess also emotional connection, but not through the static of emotional or of economic or class considerations. So she brings that lesson to Besyakov, the Besyakov movement. And then, this is the first person account of how, Tu B'Av was actually observed in the interwar period. I'll just read from it. Evening, the sun is about to set. All the seminary girls are standing in front of the villa, ready for their excursion. They set out, Sereshnir at the head, 115 girls, Sereshnir leading in the dark. We follow in the steps of our leader, our flag bearer. We walk. We follow Sereshnira, we reach a forest, it's pitch dark. Suddenly they light a campfire, a flash of light. The bonfire won't start after all these are Besyakov girls. Lighting a bonfire wasn't in the curriculum in the city. Our teachers busy themselves. We despair, but the light keeps on working with all our energy lying flat on the ground with their faces close to where a tiny spark still flickers. They add their own life force and finally the light catches. And soon a large fire is burning in the center of our circle, almost like the Jewish fire, which we kept burning for so long deep in our hearts. And then once the campfire is lit, Sereshnir stands up and gives a Torah about the fire that burned in the Beis HaMikdash. And then the girls are, you know, surround her and start dancing around the fire. And Sereshnir joins in the circle. And then the girls, as if suddenly the dancing and the singing become a kind of prayer. And then as if the way this is described, and the whole description is translated on my website, the Besyakov Project website, and then suddenly as if ripped from their souls, they start singing Lashana Haba B'Yerushalayim. So what Sereshnir has touched on, and this will be my last minute of trying to tie this up, is that the time of the multiple times that are evoked within this ritual are so rich. Not only has Sereshnir connected to Jewish historical time, the destruction of the temple, and then the promise of rebirth that is somehow brought to the, pulled out of them as if magically. So this great arc of destruction and redemption, that's the largest arc of Jewish history, is let's say activated. But there's also the arc of the individual life, that within this exile, within the long exile, we also have the moment of youth. When I interviewed a Beis Yaakov graduate who talked about how much she loved to sing in Beis Yaakov, because she knew that when she got married, this is a very Hasidic Beis Yaakov student, she would not be able to sing again out loud as often, right? Because any unmarried man at the Shabbos table, or certainly in the synagogue, she wouldn't be able to sing her heart out. So this singing and dancing your heart out is also a kind of the moment of youth, right? The moment of before marriage is one of the things that Sarah Schneerer tapped into, that's still such an important part of, right, within the life cycle. And then finally, there's the moment of the beauty of nature that was always, for Sarah Schneerer, a direct way of encountering God. And that moment of, from the darkness, lighting the fire, the most primal elements of human culture, and the recurring beauty of the woods at night, all of those came together in this ritual that Sarah Schneerer, in some ways created from new, right? This idea of a youth movement in the Orthodox world, where around them youth movements were only for secular leftists. But a youth movement that figured out how to draw from the deepest recesses of the Jewish tradition to find a spark of possibility that could be reactivated, like that spark of fire within each soul. And I think that's, for me, the religious genius of Sarah Schneerer. So I don't want to go, do I have a minute or a few to take some questions, Joe?
Should I
look
you
at the chat or take watch people's hands?
Okay, if nobody's going to ask a question, I'll throw it. So what happened to all of this? None of this got transferred to North America.
So this is really thank you for that question. It's why so Beis Yaakov in the interwar period was a different kind of movement than it is today. It was, even though the girls came from religious homes for the most part, in some sense it was a Baal Tshuva movement. Because they were, what's the word I'm looking for? Because they were, even the girls from the most religious homes, with very few exceptions, were on their way out, right? Secularization, leftism, all these were, Beis Yaakov had to fight against the enormous forces of what was happening in the interwar period, which was a just huge wave of secularization. And as that kind of pioneering, this is why the rabbis gave Sarah Schneerer permission. It's like they were desperate. Do something. Okay, you want to have a girl's school, even if it says you're not supposed to teach your daughter Torah. Okay, whatever you can do, you can do. These are emergency times. So emergency times can also be times of great religious experimentation, right? We know the Baal Tshuva movement was a moment of great religious experimentation. Beis Yaakov is now in, it's not over. Somebody wants to say it's not over. This particular type of dramatic, the leader, you know, the 50-year-old founder of the movement, making a campfire in the woods in the middle of the night, and ecstatic raves in the mountains. Maybe there's some of that in the camp, but Beis Yaakov is now trying to shore up its gains and trying to, and there's still people leaving Orthodoxy, as I know very well, but they're basically, there's a different word for it. I forget the word, revanchist. It's a different type of movement now. It's a movement to solidify its gains and to keep anybody from leaving. It's not trying to attract people.
Add to
Diane
that.
Somebody wants to speak.
Yes, I want to add to the point that you're making. So Beit Yaakov today is very, very, very different from what you were describing. Beit Yaakov in Israel today, on purpose, does not give their graduate girls Teudat Bagrut because they don't want them to go into university and continue studying. In addition to that, so the, as you know, Beit Bnei Brak. Bnei Brak is a very Haredi city in Israel, and it's located next to the Bar Ilan University. The girls in Bar Ilan University, the religious ones, they wear long skirts to the floor, and therefore,
quicken up. We're pressed for time, so if you have a question, quickly ask it, please. Sorry.
And therefore, the girls of Bnei Brak wear shorter skirts so that nobody would Chalila confuse them with the girls of the university. That's all I wanted to say.
So somebody in the chat asked about summer programs. There are certainly still summer programs, and there's certainly still nature and the recognition of the power of nature. There's still the same struggle of, is the summer a time when people get a little too relaxed? Or is the summer possibly, potentially a time of religious renewal? And I don't mean summer because it's hot. I mean, the cultural dynamics around the modern world in which summer is understood to be leisure, a certain kind of freedom, right? Young people get freedom. So can we imagine the leisure and the freedom as a time of religious ecstasy? And certainly in Beis Yaakov today, those attempts are made within, within the camps to unite the question of nature and freedom, freedom from your parents, freedom to be around. Certainly, you know, certainly that's part of, the summer camps of Beis Yaakov, and some are officially connected with the Beis Yaakov, some are just part of that whole stream. But the kind of wildness and the attempt to resurrect a long dormant religion, that's no longer the case. I don't know whether it, when I was in various Beis Yaakov camps, I went to a camp called Tubby, which sounds like a camp for fat girls, but it was actually a camp, Tichon Beis Yaakov. I don't remember observing Tu B'Av, and maybe someone, and I think that's a real shame. I think these are opportunities that are lost. And one of the reasons that I translated Sarsnir's collected writings, because I wanted to make them available as options, right? Future, past futures, or futures past, I don't know which one, that the present can still learn from. Thank you.